You're tuned to Pop Defect Radio, subversive music for dangerous times. I'm your host, Skidmark Bob, as we trek through some of the most radical, independent, uncensored, conscious music I get sent, pirate, or borrow. Please stand by.
The pledge to resist. We believe that as a people living in the United States, it is our responsibility to resist the injustices done by our government in our names. Not in our name will you wage endless war. There can be no more deaths, no more transfusions of blood for oil. Not in our name will you invade countries, bomb civilians, kill more children, letting history take its course over the graves of the nameless. Not in our names will you erode the very freedoms you have claimed to fight for. Not by our hands will we supply weapons and funding for the annihilation of families on foreign soil. Not by our mouths will we let fear silence us. Not by our hearts will we allow whole people or countries to be deemed evil. Not by our will and not in our name. We pledge resistance. We pledge alliance with those who have undergone attack for voicing opposition to the war or for their religion or ethnicity. We pledge to make common cause with the people of the world to bring about justice, freedom, and peace. Another world is possible, and we pledge to make it real.
The threat comes from Iraq. It arises directly from the Iraqi regime's own actions, its history of aggression, and its drive toward an arsenal of terror. It possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons. It is seeking nuclear weapons. As a former chief weapons inspector of the UN has said,
never been about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. It's always been about regime removal, getting rid of Saddam Hussein, because neoconservatives who populate the Bush administration have invested a tremendous amount of political capital into that. They have boxed themselves into a rhetorical corner, demonizing Saddam Hussein to the point that they have given themselves no ability to maneuver. They have to remove Saddam, and having invested so much political capital, they will suffer if they don't. And frankly speaking, because the Bush administration is not honest in regards to the disarming of Iraq, because they have put regime removal ahead of disarming Iraq, we must question their motives for what they're trying to do.
While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
They will clear the way for immediate action. They will predetermine the outcome, which will of course be regime removal, by stacking the deck against weapons inspections. And then the danger is they will manipulate the inspections in such a manner that they will provoke a crisis, and then they already have this automatic trigger in place against Saddam. That's now how it works.
Iraq's weapons of mass destruction are controlled by a murderous tyrant. The entire world has witnessed Iraq's 11-year history of defiance, deception, and bad faith. It has given shelter and support to terrorism and practices terror against its own people.
Fear of the unknown preys upon ignorance. Since September 11th, the American public has been susceptible to the politics of fear, the politics of the ignorant, and have been, you know, able to be readily convinced by speculative rhetoric that Iraq poses a threat worthy of war. The Bush administration has capitalized upon this.
Is it the responsibility of free people to do something, to take steps to deal with such a threat before such an attack occurs?
Yes, Mr. Rumsfeld, I think we need weapons inspections, not war. Why is it stopping the inspections? I think we need weapons inspections, not war.
This conflict started August 2nd when the dictator of Iraq invaded a small and helpless neighbor.
The crime has nothing to do with invasions, pretty much duplicating what the U.S. had just done a couple of months before in Panama.
Kuwait, a member of the Arab League and a member of the United Nations, was crushed. Its people brutalized. 5 months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait.
He certainly is a brutal tyrant and a mass murderer, just as he was when the U.S. was openly supporting him. The overwhelming majority of his crimes were committed during this period when he was a friend and ally.
While the world waited, Saddam Hussein systematically raped, pillaged, and plundered a tiny nation. No threat to his own.
At the time of the Halabja atrocities and later atrocities against the Kurds, the atrocities were being carried out with the support of George Bush and Margaret Thatcher.
He subjected the people of Kuwait to unspeakable atrocities. And among those maimed and murdered, innocent children.
Attack on the Kurds in northern Iraq destroyed large agricultural areas, as well as killing plenty of people, probably tens of thousands.
Innocent children.
Plenty of people, probably tens of thousands.
Murdered.
That gave Bush an opportunity to do a favor for a big U.S. agribusiness, send extensive credits to Saddam Hussein so he can purchase agribusiness exports after they had wiped out the agricultural areas in Iraq.
Others traveled to Baghdad in a variety of efforts to restore peace and justice.
So concerned to evade diplomatic efforts, and they did.
Arab leaders sought what became known as an Arab solution, only to conclude that Saddam Hussein was unwilling to leave Kuwait.
Chief of Staff Powell, in internal discussion, said the problem is that Saddam may withdraw, leaving a puppet regime in place, at which point everyone in the Arab world will be happy. That's what they expected, and they wanted to prevent.
No choice but to drive Saddam from Kuwait by force. We will not fail.
The rebelling Iraqi generals requested from the United States, from General Schwarzkopf, they wanted to obtain, they didn't want help, but they wanted access to captured Iraqi arms that they could use in their effort to overthrow the tyrant and carry out a popular revolution. That was refused. They were not permitted access to arms. Saddam Hussein was authorized to use military gunships to attack the rebels.
Air attacks are underway against military targets in Iraq. Our operations are designed to best protect the lives of all the coalition forces by targeting Saddam's vast military arsenal.
The bombers destroyed dams, water supply stations, sewage stations.
Military arsenal.
Pumping stations, electrical system. All of that amounts to biological warfare. Simply ask yourself what would happen if something comparable was done, say, in Boston. People would be dying like flies from disease and starvation.
Unspeakable atrocities.
It's biological warfare with exactly the catastrophic effect that they predicted.
Iraq will eventually comply with all relevant United Nations resolutions. And then, when peace is restored, it is our hope that Iraq will live as a peaceful and cooperative member of the family of nations, thus enhancing the security and stability of the Gulf.
The rebellion was crushed. Basra was devastated. So were other areas. And the Bush administration was pretty frank about the reasons. It was March 1991, after the so-called war. They simply preferred what they called an iron-fisted Iraqi junta to the threat of a popular revolution.
Cooperative members.
And therefore had to, in the name of what's called stability.
Stability of the Gulf.
Had to support these major atrocities.
Unspeakable atrocities.
In which, very possibly, as many or more civilians were killed during the bombing the month earlier.
We will not fail. We will fail.
over Baghdad. They called it some kind of storm on my TV.
I never saw a storm that looked like that in the sky.
Looked more like cowards dropping bombs. Tell me, they never showed you all the suffering there. Tens of thousands of children and their mothers mutilated there. There was a noise being heard. Folks from Oklahoma cheering for the absurd.
This kind of hate will go full circle someday.
They can't believe they lost the Civil War again anyway. They put their babies in the greatest kind of danger there. Stupidity results in grief almost everywhere. Sometimes my rage can start to get real old, but revenge is so much sweeter on a plate of cold. Let me make this clear, they kill beloved friends of mine. Sometimes the end justifies the means. You know that hatred is a two-way street. Your sons and daughters butchered beloved friends of mine. Now what about this Oklahoma bombing? People down there think they should be exempt from this kind of thing. Were they not cheering when their boys butchered human beings?
Did not the G80 car war on my path betray?
Jailing families trying to make a dime in Columbia. Friendly dealer life sentence. How can that make sense to you? So I walk through the valley of death. How I prayed for my very last breath.
The man who placed that bomb is a beloved friend of mine.
Sometimes the end justifies the means. Your phony grieving doesn't mean a thing. The day your babies were mangled to bits is a holiday of mine. These collars sound wrong, and as often it says, they put a daycare center in a bad building instead.
What kind of coward keeps a hostage like that?
The TEA rolls out the welcome mat. It reminds me of the movies I've seen, where the scumbag grabs a hostage, I think. You know what I mean? Sometimes my rage can start to get real old, but revenge is so much sweeter on a place of cold. Let me make this clear, you kill beloved friends of mine.
Sometimes the end justifies the means.
You know that hatred is a two-way street. Your sons and daughters have killed beloved friends of mine.
So I walk through the valley of death.
How I prayed for my very last breath.
Your God is but a wretched son of mine.
Sometimes the end justifies the means.
Your phony grieving doesn't mean a thing.
The day your babies were mangled to bits is a holiday of mine.
We'll be right back.
In 1991, most Americans were very happy that the Gulf War apparently had ended. It was a quick, decisive victory, and hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops were returning home to parades. What happened a few months later was that thousands of veterans started to report medical problems, such as achy joints, memory problems. They kept falling ill, they were getting rashes, and there was no explanation.
Rhonda Habib, Agence France-Presse, Jordan.
Concerning the use of the type of weapons used by the Allies in the Gulf War, the first warning came from soldiers themselves, whether in Britain or in the U.S., when they started complaining of symptoms, and that was related to the Gulf War and to the use of the weapons. So it's obvious that it took so long until people took it seriously, because there was this conspiracy of silence.
Paul Sullivan.
The first response of the United States military and the United States government was to ignore it, to deny that there was any problem with the health status of American Gulf War veterans.
Rhonda Habib.
You had to keep the image of the good guys, namely the Allied, and the bad guy, who is Saddam. It's Saddam Hussein who would use chemical weapons and who would harm his own population and the world with this type of weapons. And it didn't look very nice to show that the Allies have been themselves using weapons that were harmful.
Over 696,000 U.S. troops served in the Gulf War. 183,629, almost one in four, filed for disability. 9,592 died as of January 2002.
You gotta die, gotta die for your government. Die for your country, that shit. In the 1970s through the 1980s, the Pentagon, in complete secrecy, started experimenting with a new type of high perforation shell made of the heaviest, hardest, most plentiful metal around, readily available without mining costs or efforts. A metal that just happened to be sitting there in the hands of the U.S. Department of Energy. Uranium waste.
Nuclear physicist Dr. Doug Rocky.
The U.S. Department of Energy and other nations that are involved in the enrichment have tremendous amounts of this waste left over, and they needed to find a use for it.
Depleted uranium rounds reached combat for the first time during the Gulf War. These rounds pierce anything known to this day, penetrating the thickest armor plates like butter. The downside, they are radioactive, contain traces of plutonium, the most toxic metal on Earth, and their debris remain radioactive for about 4.5 billion years.
Weapons of Mass Destruction, Iraq had them. In 1991, the international community determined that because Iraq had invaded its neighbors, behaved irresponsibly, and had chemical, biological, nuclear, and long-range ballistic missiles, that it represented a clear and present risk to international peace and security, and they determined that these weapons would be removed. They created weapons inspectors to go into Iraq to overdo that. That's where I came in. When they created the weapons inspectors to send them into Iraq to get rid of weapons of mass destruction, the decision was that Iraq would have to give up all of its information, make a declaration listing the totality of its information about all of its weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, nuclear, long-range ballistic missiles. Information is what fuels inspections. See, I can't do an inspection unless I know where to go, if I know what I'm looking for. So Iraq was supposed to declare everything, and then the first inspectors would come in with a clipboard, piece of paper, go in and say, okay, 15 bombs, check them off, and that's it. But what happens when the Iraqis lie? As they did. So Iraq didn't want to give up their weapons of mass destruction, so they told massive lies. They denied having a nuclear weapons program. They denied having a biological weapons program. They declared less than 50% of their chemical capability, less than 50% of their ballistic missile capability. They lied. So if information is the fuel that drives inspections and the Iraqis tell a lie up front, how can the inspectors do their job? They can't. So you had a whole bunch of really highly qualified chemists, biologists, nuclear physicists, and rocket scientists milling around, not able to do anything. So they bring me in. The spy. You see, my job is to get information, gather data, so I could take that information and empower the smart guys to go into Iraq and do their job. But this is a different proposition altogether, because the way the game was supposed to work is that Iraq provides the data, then we inspect. Now we have to go in and collect the data, bring it back, and then inspect. It's a different game altogether. Now, it requires us to do things in Iraq that the Security Council didn't necessarily envision us doing up front. This is supposed to be a gentleman's agreement. Suddenly they bring in somebody who's not quite a gentleman. Gathering information is a delicate business, especially when the people who you're gathering information from don't want you to gain access to it. Protect that information with guys with guns. So it's not a matter of just walking up to a door, knocking on it, opening up and saying, I'm here to get the information that you're hiding from. You have to use tricks that police people, you know, police officers use when you're investigating a criminal. You want to find out if a guy's selling drugs or running numbers? Intercept his phone calls. Tap his phone. We want to find out if Iraq's hiding weapons? We tap their phone. It's not that easy, though. See, here in the United States, the cops sort of have all the power. In Iraq, the Iraqis have all the power. So that's why they bring in sneaky guys who can go in and tap the communications without getting caught. Now, normally you call this spying. Spying, short for espionage. Espionage basically is a situation where a nation's laws are being violated to gain access to it. In the case of Iraq, they're not allowed to have this information. See, they're, by law, they have to give it up, turn it over. They chose to hide it, to retain it. But there is no legal protection for this data. So it gives the inspectors pretty much a green light to do anything they want to do to gain access to this. So now I can tap their phones. I can't get caught because they'll kill me. They'll kill my guys doing it. I can fly airplanes overhead and take pictures. I can recruit people on the inside. Don't get caught doing it, though, because they'll kill them. It's a dangerous game we're playing here, but it collects information. And this information fuels inspections. And eventually, we're able to force the Iraqis to admit that they lied to us. Now, you've heard people say that the weapons inspectors destroyed more Iraqi weapons of mass destruction than all U.S. military action did during Desert Storm. Well, let's be honest here. Weapons inspectors, we never found a single weapon in Iraq. Never found a single weapon in Iraq. We never hunted down and destroyed a single weapon in Iraq. And yet, I can stand here and tell you that we can account for 90 to 95% of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction capability. Now, how do you make that leap there, Scott? You just said that you didn't find anything, but you can account for it. So what the, you know, how many times does a cop go in and just open the door and find, you know, the body laying there? No, you have to get the criminal to confess the crime. Then the criminal leads you to where the body's hidden. This is what we did in Iraq. We gathered the data, and we confronted the Iraqis with their lies. We confronted them with their mistruths. We confronted them with the inconsistencies in their story. And it took time. It wasn't easy and it wasn't pretty. But by 1996, 5 years after this process began, we were able to force the Iraqis to admit they had a nuclear program, to find that nuclear program, and we eliminated that nuclear program. Admit a biological weapons program, define it, we eliminated it. The same thing with chemical, the same thing with ballistic missile. We were very successful. Now, I can also tell you that we did this without believing a single word the Iraqis ever told us. See, they lied to us once, we just assumed everything they told us was a lie. So how do we get 90-95%? We'd go to Europe, the nations that sold Iraq this material. And we'd hunt down the bills of lading, the invoices, the receipts, the letters of credit, how much money was spent. And we'd go to the Iraqis and we'd say, how many machines of type A did you buy? They'd say, oh, two. And here they are. One was blown up in this building and the other one's over here dismantled. All destroyed. We're clean. We slide a document that says they bought 12. And we'd demand to know where the other 10 were. And they'd have to take us to them. And that's how we disarmed them. I keep going. I keep going to work. I keep spying on these facilities, trying to find out where Saddam Hussein's hiding his material. But what happens at the end of the day when we're so good at collecting this data that we've collected everything we can about Saddam Hussein's security, and we start to realize that they're not hiding anything. There's nothing left. We probably can go to the Security Council and close the books and say, we've succeeded. We've disarmed Iraq. That's the last thing the United States wants. Because what happens if you declare victory? You say, boss, we disarmed Iraq. They have nothing left. Now the United States has to go back to the rule of law, which says that if Iraq has been disarmed, you have to lift economic sanctions. Remember America's policy. It's not about disarming Iraq, ladies and gentlemen. It's about getting rid of Saddam Hussein. So the last thing you can have happen is that Iraq is disarmed. So now who becomes the enemy to the United States? The inspectors. We become the threat. Our success isn't just handing the United States a tremendous intelligence jackpot in terms of Saddam's security, but it threatens their policy of getting Saddam Hussein altogether. So what do? You have to wait till you get enough data to take out Saddam, and then you have to kill the inspectors. How do that? You start manipulating the work of the inspectors, corrupting the process, corrupting the integrity of the investigation. Asking the cops to plant evidence. Asking the cops to do illegal wiretaps. Asking the cops to become the bad guys. Which is what happened. You see, as long as we're focused on hunting down Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, we're okay. I told you, Iraq doesn't have any right to that information. But as inspectors, we were compelled to respect the dignity, the sovereignty, and the national security of Iraq when we did our work. This means that we can't spy on Saddam Hussein's security. It has nothing to do with our mandate of disarming Saddam. We can go after weapons. We can't go after Saddam. The United States asked us to go after Saddam. In December 1998, the United States used the weapons inspection to deliberately provoke a crisis with Iraq. To go in, force the Iraqis into a situation where they stopped cooperating with the inspectors, and then the United States ordered the inspectors out. Iraq never kicked them out. The United States ordered the inspectors out, and then bombed Iraq, going after Saddam Hussein, using the information that the inspectors gathered. Now, the idea is that they'd get Saddam Hussein, kill him, and that would be the end of the story. But they had a little ace up their sleeve. You see, what happens if you don't get Saddam? If you don't kill him? You have to still contain him. How do you contain him? By making the allegations that he still has weapons of mass destruction. But what about those inspectors who were closing in on the final 5%? No. Those inspectors are dead now. You see, because when the United States pulled the inspectors out and then used the inspectors' information to bomb Saddam Hussein, when Saddam Hussein emerged from the rubble and said, I'm still alive, you inspectors are never coming back in here. Because you're not here to disarm me. You're here to kill me. I reject you coming back. That's what happened. You've heard a lot of talk about how Iraq kicked the inspectors out. They didn't. The United States pulled the inspectors out. You heard a lot of talk about how Iraq obstructed the work of the inspectors. Yeah, they did. I'm not trying to give them a clean bill of health. But you have to understand that the United States also corrupted the process of inspection.
In a September 7th press conference with Prime Minister Tony Blair at Camp David, President Bush cited a report by the International Atomic Energy Agency that said Iraq was 6 months away from developing a nuclear weapon when inspectors pulled out in 1998. The agency now says they never published such a report. David Albright worked at the agency from 1992 to 1997. He's now president of the Institute for Science and International Security. And he says that any time frame for Iraqi nuclear development would have been speculation.
They had essentially had nothing in 1998. I mean, there were suspicions that there were some activities. A term of art would be maybe they're spinning a centrifuge or two someplace.
Albright says there was never consensus within the agency on the time Iraq would need to develop nuclear weapons. The White House has said that the president misspoke and was referring to a 1991 report by the agency. The agency claims no 1991 report on timing was released.
Thank you. Mr. President, I don't want to be in your military. I don't want to bury my own kind. I want to make up my own mind about who I hate, not what the national slate has in mind. You see, the American interest is rarely in mine. And I've got my own wars to wage. I don't need to engage in your war for oil overseas. In between my lover's legs is slick enough for me. I'm the lesbian minority, see? So I don't need a major to tell me what to be or who to do things to somewhere across the Pacific. My sex is too specific to report to a general. And in general, dykes don't respond to commands, so why do we demand to be a part of this irrational masculine swarmy that poses as a national army? See, I've seen armies, seen them on picket lines, welfare lines, seen them storming the Capitol, storming the streets, demanding justice and peace. I've heard of armies in history, Birmingham, Montgomery, but these dressed-to-kill boys with their made-to-kill toys, these yellow ribbons that choke trees, please, it's a joke, a sadistic display of militaristic play that ends in American dreams. For the owners of both teams. And who suffers? Who buffers the attack? Who lacks the cash to decline the invitation to the nation's most expensive party? Those hardy boys promised schooling, then sent on their way to collect their pay from the grave. Well, this gay don't mind being war depraved. Honey, we can fight for more than big boys and their money. I'd rather fight Phil Knight, bomb all his bombs. I'd rather wage a gay crusade on the Pope, quote my girl in front of his nose. I'd rather pose a problem to Disney, expose Michael Eisner as a miser, Mickey Mouse as leader of the rat race. I'd slice right down that rodent's face. And it's a disgrace to be a rapist of developing nations when we can't stop the rape of developing girls. I'd rather unfurl an attack on our money-guzzling, undercover, embezzling enemies, impersonating just us with no dollar power, impersonating justice from their Donald Trump tower. Yes, our million enemies with their $1 billion, with their trillion crimes, waging their personal war on the poor for more power in this world of ABC, CBS, NBC. This country runs from CEO to shining CEO, sending us across the ocean for the promotion of their cash devotion ideology. Well, I don't desire your superstar badge of bravery for enduring modern-day slavery in your maniacally, economically driven death trap. Anyway, I'd give the U.S. a bad rap. I'd kiss every fine Iraqi dyke on the front line. Fuck national pride. I'd go to their side. I prefer cross-national desire to crossfire anyway. And I don't need your fatigue uniform to perform my battles. I'm wearing layers of tire just from battling the liars of our system every day. And my dear Mr. President, I'd rather die lying in the heat of a fuck I call mine than the fucking line of duty you've made mine. But fine. It's the new big thing to demand inclusion in your land intrusion ethic-free military, to request same-sex affirmative action, to defactionalize who dies in your money for the man C-SPAN cam scam lost and found game you call war, where we get to lose our lives when you've found what's worth more. Well, when this dyke dies, she'll go down knowing what it's for.
Iraq, one of the most ancient civilizations on Earth, home of the Garden of Eden, Babylon, the ancient city of Ur, an oil-rich country blessed with an abundance of natural resources, home to the mighty Tigris and the immortal Euphrates. Iraqis pride themselves on being some of the oldest and richest people on Earth, but for 12 years, Iraq's 22 million people have lived in pure misery, in the cradle of civilization. They live under an unprecedented regime of economic sanctions and regular U.S. bombings, in a land polluted from a war that for them has never ended. A country once praised for having the most advanced medical and education systems in the Middle East has been hurled back generations. Estimates drawn from UN figures say that as many as 1 million children have died as a direct result of the sanctions. All of this while Saddam Hussein remains firmly in power. Now, more than a decade after the Gulf War, George W. Bush is resurrecting his father's unfulfilled promise to bring down Saddam.
Iraq continues to flaunt its hostility toward America and to support terror. This is a regime that has something to hide from the civilized world. States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world. The price of indifference would be catastrophic.
Down, down, Bush! Down, down, Bush! Down, down, Bush! Down, down, Bush! Down, down, Bush!
Down. It's a chant that hasn't been heard in Iraq since the 1991 Gulf War. Down, down, Bush. This chant wasn't written for the current U.S. president. It was the rally cry here against his father a decade ago, during the war the Iraqis call the mother of all battles. But with Little Bush, as the Iraqis call him, threatening a new war, the chant is making a comeback.
Down, down, Bush! Down, down, Bush! Down, down, Bush!
Iraqis everywhere are well aware of Bush's specific threat to change the regime in Baghdad. But 12 years of deadly economic sanctions and almost constant bombardment have smashed any potential support the administration could hope to win inside the country. Even those Iraqis who are against Saddam Hussein say they would never support a change of government brought about by a Washington-orchestrated coup or another massive bombing. With our souls, with our blood, we will defend you, O Saddam. In Iraq today, chants like these have taken on a new meaning. They've come to represent not the people's undying love for their president, but a message of defiance against Washington. Bush's threats are making the government in Baghdad all the more powerful. Already, most Iraqis live in a state of fear and terror. Saddam Hussein's name is almost never mentioned in any context, on the streets, in the souks, or in the taxis. The threat of war has led to an even further lockdown of the country, with secret police watching everyone. Public opposition to the regime is unheard of. But the people view America, and not Saddam, as the primary source of their misery, with almost everyone vowing to resist any American attack, regardless of what Bush states is the goal. Senior Iraqi officials say they believe the U.S. will attack sometime in the next year, but they say Bush will not succeed in bringing down the government. Dr. Abdul al-Hashimi is an influential member of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party and a former federal minister.
The threat is there. American military activities is on every day in Iraq in the no-fly zones. So one thing we can do, and we know for sure that we can defend Iraq. One thing we know for sure that we can prevent American administration from achieving its objectives in Iraq. That one thing for sure we know. But when the American administration is going to decide to hit Iraq, they will do that. And they will find an excuse for themselves to do that. Nothing we can do about it.
And all nations should know America will do what is necessary to ensure our nation's security.
President Bush has never been to the south of Iraq, where the U.S. government holds the rare distinction of being more despised than Saddam. In 1991, after the Gulf War, the Shiites heeded Bush's father's call for them to rise up against the regime, only to find American forces stand idly by as Saddam's troops mercilessly crush the Shiite rebellion. Overwhelmingly, the people of the South say they will never forgive America for this. Air raid sirens sound in the distance. The war that doesn't end has just struck the south of Iraq once again. The region is attacked on an almost daily basis by American and British warplanes, operating in the so-called no-fly zones. Washington says its planes are there to protect the Shiite Muslims from Saddam, but everywhere people in the south say it's the American missiles that terrorize them. The Iraqi government says that more than 1,300 civilians have been killed in these attacks. Through the windy roads and alleys of the poor Al-Jumariya neighborhood in the southern port city of Basra lies a street now known as Missile Street. It was named after a deadly U.S. bombing on January 25, 1999, which killed four small children. Among the dead, a six-year-old boy named Haider. His mother, a primary school teacher, still carries his name. In Iraqi culture, a woman takes the name of her firstborn and is forever known as the mother of that child. On a hot June evening, Haider, the mother of Haider, sits on the floor in her home on Missile Street and remembers that morning in January.
Till now, I didn't forget what's happened in that day. In 1930, in the morning, we were sitting in the... I was teaching my children, and big voice, and become nearly. Then a big bomb happened. The glasses of the windows and the dishes and cups, glasses in the kitchen, all of them fall down and broken. Then my face is, and two children with me, Hindu and Al Hamza, they were with me, but Mustafa and Haider, they were out in the street. Then our faces is full of blood because the glasses of the windows and the dishes. Then I left them and remember my two children, they were out in the street. I take my cover and run quickly to the street. I saw the street is full of smoke and dust, and it was like midnight. Then I run quickly and call my children. Haider, Mustafa, Haider, Mustafa. I didn't find them. At last, I saw a small hill of broken wood and iron and pieces of and dust. And then I said, my old son Mustafa Haider, full of blood. His face is, the blood is covered his face and his body, his head, and a circle of blood under his head on the ground. I didn't forget that, never. And he closed his eyes. Then I call him, touch him, and he didn't answer me.
Haider's other son, Mustafa, survived the attack. He lost two fingers and lives with shrapnel in his liver.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying for your freedom in this land? Who pays the cost for the liberties you demand? Is it for freedom? Or our comfort and convenience? Is it to profit for big business we pledge our allegiance? Are we prisoners in the land of the brave and the bold? Held by indifference or hearts grown hard and cold? And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying for your freedom in this land? Who pays the cost for the liberties you demand? Children of the world, you have the right to sing and dance, run and play, let your dreams take flight. As the innocent die, you rulers carry the shame. And if we stand idly by, we share in the blame. And oh, America, do we care? Oh, America, are we aware? Who's dying for our comfort in this land? Who pays the cost for the convenience we demand? Children of the world, you have the right to sing and dance, run and play, let your dreams take flight.